So Levi, I've been having bad dreams.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
About what? Why?
About everything. About, I don't even know. Some of them are nightmares. Well, they're all unpleasant. They're not all exactly nightmares in the sense of, you know, something being absolutely terrifying or just supernatural or far-fetched or anything. Sometimes they're just sort of low-rent work stress dreams.
Stress.
But some of the other kind, the other night, I was fighting a home intruder in my sleep, and I launched myself out of the bed while still asleep, cleared a couple of feet, and then hit the floor, which could have been worse because our two-year-old, who, as many two-year-olds do, often has trouble sleeping, was sleeping on her little backup bed on a mattress beside our bed. So I landed just shy of her, you know, bang, on the hardwood floor, woke her up. She was amused to learn that the dads have bad dreams too.
Yeah,
but you know it's COVID season, so it's a phenomenon, right? Lots of people are having bad dreams.
Yeah, I've never had like work nightmares. I've over the last couple of months of COVID, and in case you're listening to this in the year 2022. 2020 sucks.
Yeah, if you were in a coma through all of 2020, you were lucky. Count yourself lucky.
Yeah. I've had these work dreams where it's almost like there's so much happening that I can't possibly handle it. And that's the nightmare. Like, that's it. There's no, like...
Like, you just can't keep up or catch up?
Yeah, and there's, like, I'll have instances where I'm late. And that brings a lot of stress to me while I'm asleep. I don't know why. I guess I'm afraid to screw up. And then I'll have a dream where I become so overwhelmed I just quit in the middle of the shift. By the way, I work at a coffee shop and I'm the beer manager at said coffee shop as well. I won't give you the name though.
We can't have our legions of fans showing up. I mean, storming. all the women that listen to this, we can't have them showing up and
then
interrupting you.
My nightmare at work would become reality.
I mean, for one thing, then who would keep feeding me the espresso, the volume
the
of
fuel.
Espresso I need to continue
the fuel
just to operate?
You'd have to find someone else.
I don't want to do that. I don't want new people.
Yeah, no one does. It's a weird phenomenon that's happening right now. And I'm sure some of you are aware of it, others are not. People are having terrifying, intense nightmares while in quarantine or during this entire COVID breakout. And there's research to show that this is true.
Well, if there's research, then we know that we can absolutely trust it.
Yeah, I'm not gonna come on here and say something that we have no background.
So there was an article in Time about a recent dream survey conducted by a professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School, which confirmed that the incidence of vivid dreams, not necessarily nightmares, but unusually vivid dreams, has increased significantly as the coronavirus has spread around the world. I guess this has been known to happen in the past during incredibly widespread stressful events like after 9/11. So it's happening to a lot of people. You can get on Twitter if you can stand to get on. Actually, don't get on Twitter. Twitter's a garbage fire right now. We all need to safeguard what is left of our mental health as civilization burns to the ground. But if you wanted to get on Twitter, you would find a lot of self-reporting of the kind of dreams people have been having in quarantine. I'm not somebody who usually remembers my dreams.
Yeah.
Of course, I don't typically haven't slept enough for the last, 10 years to...
insomnia.
Yeah. My chronic insomnia. Yeah. Or as I call them, my beautiful children.
Yes.
I haven't always slept enough to really remember my dreams, but the last 6 months, I almost always remember them because, you know, I guess that means that you wake up during them if you remember them.
They're fresh on your mind.
Yeah.
Because apparently throughout time, like throughout your day, you'll start losing parts of your dream that you remembered like as soon as you woke up. And that comes with like the vividness of the dream too. Like I don't really remember my dreams either, but over the last, I guess we're in the eighth month of 2020, 6 months of the pandemic, over the last 6 months, I'm starting to, over the last 6 months, I'm starting to really feel the vividness of the dreams I'm having. And they're all work related, which is a big stress of life right now, because we're having to deal with the public and maskers versus anti-maskers and 6 feet apart and blah, blah, blah.
Well, you know, when most people are walking around stressed out, I mean, you know, they're carrying that stress around with them, and you work in the service industry. So, yeah. I mean, I work in IT, and the emails that I'd get have gotten sort of increasingly, snippier as time has gone on.
So, there's a natural there. What I looked at researching this was there's a National Geographic, article. And it's called The Pandemic is Giving People Vivid, Unusual Dreams, and Here's Why. So basically what this article says is that in situations of change or high stress, we tend to, our brain tends to sort of stay awake a little bit more in our REM sleep.
As like a watch out mechanism, like a watch for danger sort of thing.
Yes. And so therefore it's easier for us to recall those said dreams, because our brains are wired at moments of stress to kind of alert itself. And so, I mean, if I have a dream about, driving a pizza, or a car that's run by pizza, I'm probably not going to remember it as much as, a very stressful situation happened at work and I got fired for it and that was my dream. I would probably remember the latter more than I remember the former because of the stress that it caused.
Do you find, you know, when you have these recent ones, do you find that the feeling of them like follows you throughout the day? I've had some about where my wife and I were arguing, like a dream about us arguing. Mm-hmm. And then, this is something I used to make fun of her for, but recently I was pissed at her for like half a day because of something that happened in a dream. And I knew it was ridiculous.
It
I told
over.
Her about it, but yeah, but no, the whole day I was like, I can't believe she would not. I kept having to tell myself, hey, dummy.
Well, yeah,
that wasn't real.
And according to this article, it says science has long suggested that dream content and emotions are connected to the well-being of us while we are awake. So it absolutely does carry on throughout the day. I've had dreams about certain people in my life that are strange, and then I see them in person that day and I feel completely different about that person, you know, because it's so real to me. I guess it's your brain automatically does that. It's like, oh, this happened. I mean, your brain, I guess, can't really tell the difference. I don't know. That's an interesting, because, yeah, it definitely affects your well-being throughout the day and maybe the weeks and years.
Well, for those who are wondering what our personal lives and sleep habits have to do with horror movies, this week's movie is Nightmare on Elm Street, the original.
1984.
By Wes Craven. And it, of course, is all about nightmares, bad dreams, the blurring line between reality and our dreams, what might cross over between that boundary from time to time. Notable also, a lot of people I think don't know this, but Johnny Depp's very first major motion picture.
Yeah, and the opening titles of the film, it says introducing Johnny Depp.
Before he was anybody.
Before he was anybody. I mean, they looked at, apparently they like, screen tested like Nicolas Cage, Charlie Sheen. But Wes Craven's daughter thought Johnny Depp was, quote, dreamy compared to the other ones. So they, I mean, no pun intended, dreamy.
dreamy.
So they
I
cast
see what you did
yeah,
there.
Yeah. Yeah. So they casted him as this character.
And he pulls his weight. I don't think you see much of the charismatic figure he would become. I mean, you know, he's the nice boyfriend. He's the boyfriend who doesn't throw a fit when he's denied sex.
Yes, he visually gets upset.
Well,
but
yeah,
he
look.
Does
he's
yeah,
like,
yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Great, fine.
Yeah, yeah.
We're
this
staying
is no
here
fun.
Together. I get it.
But yeah, he plays like a stereotypical.
He's a nice
good
guy,
looking, nice teenager. You do not get the the character actor that he became.
There's
later
no, there's no
on.
Jack Sparrow. No glimmer of
he
Jack
looks
Sparrow.
Like a little boy. It's hard to even recognize. I mean, you recognize him, but he doesn't even sound the same. He's still got baby fat. His hair is hugely 80s with so much hairspray. I mean, it stands like 6 inches up. He's got that like pompadour 80s. I don't even know.
I gotta tell you, I felt a lot of jealousy because, you know, I got the hair's going and
it's going.
Every time I see somebody with that mane, I feel a little pain.
I mean, he was probably 19, so don't, you know.
Well, I get it.
Beat yourself up.
I get it.
But yeah, so.
So he's in there and he lasts for a surprisingly long time. Yeah. You know, in movies like these, you know, these 80s horror films, the progression of who's going to die and when is fairly predictable if you've mm-hmm. watched many of them at all, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, and usually the nice guy gets killed early.
Yeah, certainly by the first half.
Yeah.
But Depp in this movie, he makes it well into the last third.
I didn't realize that. So I've seen this movie multiple times, but I guess I was introduced to it in my childhood. One of my friends was really into Freddy Krueger. And I didn't realize how much Johnny Depp was actually in this film. I'd forgotten. For some reason, my brain was like, yeah, oh, he dies in like the first 20 minutes of the film. He makes it all the way to the last third of the film. Like, there's probably like 30 minutes left when he takes his demise, which is a very interesting, great horror historical death when it comes to Johnny Depp's death in A Nightmare on Elm Street. Actually, Elm Street's never even mentioned in this movie either. Which is
oh, that's weird. Right. I always forget that. We were talking about this before we started recording. Is mm-hmm. that you know, for those of you who are familiar with the franchise, The Nightmare on Elm Street, go back and watch the original because you'll be surprised at how much of the lore and the backstory and what you think you remember about the first movie are actually in the sequels.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like Freddy's like entire backstory is in the sequels. You get a little bit of it in this film. You get the song, One, Two, Freddy's Coming for You, which apparently was written by the lead actor's boyfriend at the time. He wrote that nursery rhyme or whatever.
He did a good job.
Yeah, I know. It's really creepy. But yeah, you don't really get a lot of his backstory. He was originally designed to be the silent stalker serial killer, which was so formative already at the time with Michael Myers and Jason Voorhees. But only in the later on in the sequels, they developed his like dark humor, you know, welcome to primetime, bitch, type of stuff, which I'm going to be honest with you guys. I don't like it.
I think it
throws me off. I don't
like
his dark humor.
The more personality he gets mm-hmm. in the sequels, I think the less.
Yeah, it's not even mysterious.
No, the thing that makes the original, I think, most watchable is how much of it is unexplained mm-hmm. in the service of the movie itself feeling very dreamlike. Because there are movies that mm-hmm. establish, you know, sort of how the supernatural element is going to work, and they stick to those rules.
Yeah, or they'll use a different lens for the dream sequence so that the audience knows it's a dream. What makes me think of is that 70s show or Saved by the Bell, whenever they would sit there and daydream and the waves would come over and the...
Should have had some of those.
Yeah, I'm glad he decided not to do that. And what that causes is a confusion between what's real and what's not, which actually plays... Is one of the stronger suits of this film.
Yeah.
It's written by Wes Craven. Before this film, he had written his first written film was The Last House on the Left, the original. And then he wrote The Hills Have Eyes, and then I believe he wrote Swamp Thing in 82. Then he wrote this. So Jonathan and I both thought Swamp Thing was after A Nightmare on Elm Street. Apparently it wasn't. It was 2 years before A Nightmare on Elm Street.
I thought The Hills Have Eyes was mm-hmm. after Elm Street as well.
Part two was.
Okay, but
no. Yeah, but no, yeah. So his first, yeah, I guess what got him into Hollywood was he wrote Last House on the Left and wrote The Hills Have Eyes. There's always that like disturbing darkness written in his films. And the main, like, villains have some sort of messed up backstory or...
Yeah, it's always there's always some sort of either family or community or neighborhood secret, right?
Yeah, that's
this
it.
Is driving
that's
a lot it. Of mm-hmm. it. I mean, like, you know, the people under the stairs, mm-hmm. you know, creepy family doing God knows what in their
yeah, it's
their cut off mansion. Then you've got the Hills Have Eyes, creepy family living mm-hmm. out mm-hmm. In the desert. Mm-hmm. And in this movie, of course, the family secret is
they murdered
yes,
Freddy Krueger.
Yes, Freddy Krueger yeah, was yeah. in fact murdered. Yeah. Although it's not like he didn't deserve it.
Exactly. Yeah, that's where it gets.
He wasn't like, a victim.
Yeah, and I thought, like, what is Wes Craven trying to say here? Like they rightfully murdered this bastard.
Yeah. So he was
he's a
child killer.
Yeah.
You know, this is his origin story. He was a mm-hmm. child killer, and the neighborhood folks just decided to take matters into their own hands.
Sort of like Murder on the Orient Express, if you're wanting a like literature example, where it's all these good people make a bad decision to kill this evil person.
But then, spoiler alert. So, you know, in a lot of revenge stories, the supernatural ones, it's because somebody was wrongly killed. So
yeah.
they come back to avenge their mm-hmm. unjust death. In this case, he very much deserved what happened to him. But in this universe, he still gets to come back and avenge and, well, you know,
yeah.
do more killing, come after the children of mm-hmm. the people who
that killed him, yeah.
who burned him alive.
Yeah. And that's why he looks the way he does. Obviously, he's been burnt to a crisp. It never really gets into why he chooses the glove other than, like, in the
classic
film,
Freddy Krueger knife. Yeah,
knife for fingers. Wes Craven wanted to give him a practical weapon, but something that was more terrifying than just a kitchen knife. So they came up with this glove idea, and in the first shot of the film, it's like a montage of him making this glove, and that's actually a stunt performer, because Wes Craven wanted a stunt performer to play Freddy Krueger after he went through tons. He finally realized he needed a real actor, so he chose Robert Englund. And the first time Robert Englund put the glove on, he cut himself because these
were
real.
Yeah. Real knives.
They wanted real fear from the actors.
That probably helps in the scenes where he's chasing the teenagers around, right? It's like,
yeah.
Hey, kids, don't let him actually catch up to you.
Don't let Robert catch up to you because he will cut you. Yeah, and it worked.
I don't think SAG allows that anymore.
No, I don't think we can get away with that.
There's union rules.
Yeah. But it's just interesting because they went through so much. I mean, he did a lot of practical effects for this movie, including the glove. And so over 500 gallons of fake blood was used for this film. Mainly in the Johnny Depp death scene, and in one of my favorite scenes towards the beginning of the film, and we'll go back into that here in a little. We're going to go into our favorite shots and the timestamp, so y'all can go look at them if you choose to.
Well, of course, everyone's going to.
Yeah.
A lot of familiar horror movie tropes or references, I think, you know, are easy to catch in this one. The first third has a very, I think you said this, a very sort of Halloween feel, like a John Carpenter.
Yeah, like someone is stalking.
Yeah, both in
the
terms
children.
just both in terms of like the pacing mm-hmm. and even the score a little bit.
Yeah, that first scene though, where his arms are stretched out, is a little bit before this, so we do actually get to see Freddy do his work before we get him stalking Nancy. So. And it's weird, guys. It's got a weird feel because you have no idea who this person is. You have no idea why he's killing, why he has knives for fingers, blah, blah, blah. They don't set that up till later.
Yeah, again, because it's, you know, in a movie that is about dreams, about mm-hmm. nightmares, that is very dreamlike,
mm-hmm.
He made, you know, Wes Craven made the choice to just relieve himself of explaining all sorts of things.
Yeah, and Robert Englund plays it so well. So apparently he pulled inspiration from Nosferatu, and how the character in Nosferatu moves. And so if you realize that watching it, you'll see him actually do like the hand above, you know, that's in this like swan shape, what, and the hands moving in front of him, and the way his movements are. And what we'll go back into, one of my favorite shots in the film is just his profile. He has a very distinct profile, Freddy Krueger does. And yeah, it's all because of Robert Englund.
The other trope that I wanted to mention is of course the, if you are wondering who the first person to die in the cast is, you just have to wait for the first person to have sex.
Yeah, that is,
which is one of the reasons. It's one of the reasons that Johnny Depp makes it so long, right? Yeah, his girlfriend did him a huge favor.
Doesn't have sex,
but yeah. You know,
and that's a trope and a rule that's like written in his later film, Scream. Yeah, I mean, he writes in that movie. He writes so many things about what he did as like Drew Barrymore in the first scene in Scream, which is one of my favorite scenes in any horror movie. Says, oh yeah, Freddy Krueger, the first one was good, but the rest sucked. And like, Wes Craven wrote that line, and he wrote all of those sequels. So it's just, he jabs at himself a lot. There's a janitor who Freddy Krueger's character was a janitor at a school, and that's how he got the children. There's a janitor in Scream that has the striped red and green sweater. And it's just little things like that that Wes Craven does that's, I think, is great. He knocks himself down to size. It's funny and meta.
And so you were telling me before also that that he got the idea for this movie from an actual a sleep condition, a pretty terrifying one that had been going around in the 80s. And it was what? Sudden Unexpected Death Syndrome?
Also known as SUDS.
That's a hell of a name.
Yeah. Yeah, the CDC published a report in 1992 detailing sudden unexpected deaths during sleep among mostly young male Southeast Asian refugees in the United States. Some people are saying it was caused by an incredible amount of stress becoming a new citizen in America and dealing with that. 33 of those who died, 33 of those who died from this, from SUDS, according to the CDC, were from Laos, four of them were from Vietnam, and one was from Cambodia. The abruptness of the deaths reported here is compatible with a cardiac arrest, the report stated, but the underlying mechanism remains unclear. So what inspired Wes Craven was the mystery of it. We still don't know what caused 36 young men from Southeast Asia to... number one, avoid sleep and be terrified to go to sleep. And then once they fall asleep, they died in their sleep. It's pretty terrifying to think about. And yeah, I could see how someone who is looking for new material to write a horror movie, that would be the basis of it. And so that's how he came up with, well, what if an evil entity was actually killing them in their dreams? So yeah, dreams are quite powerful.
Well, yeah, and from a practical standpoint, from a survival standpoint, sleep itself is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what? You want to take human beings in our primitive state, you're surrounded by thousands of animals that want to kill you. Mm-hmm. And then in the most vulnerable time of the day, mm-hmm. the night, when the sun goes away, right? Yeah. It's dark. There's no electricity. Mm-hmm. You've got shit for light unless you've got a campfire.
Yeah.
But then your body's going to force you to spend 8 hours unconscious.
Completely unaware. Yeah, and helpless. I mean, so that's where...
I mean, that's just bad design.
It's just an inherent fear. Like, it's like the main reason we're afraid of the dark. It's the unknown, you know? Like, we don't... And people get really terrified in situations they can't control. And you cannot control what happens around you or to you when you're asleep. And it's a basic fear. And I think Wes Craven did a really good job of relying on that to create this saga, the Freddy Krueger saga.
And there are times when even, you know, a lot of this movie, the tension is the character awake or asleep? There are times when you just can't be certain. Mm-hmm. But there are times when, I mean, that happens to even healthy people. One of my kids, our 5-year-old, she's had sleepwalking. She sleepwalks and has had night terrors for several years. Mm-hmm. And there will be times when she'll walk into our room and you're not sure right away, is she awake and needing something, yeah, or is she sleepwalking?
And she's five?
Yeah. And the really creepy thing is that sometimes she'll talk to you in either state.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That is creepy.
And some of the things that she says, you know, there's nothing like waking up at 2 a.m., and then you find, you know, your precious little girl sort of standing over you with, like, her eyes half open.
Terrifying.
Just breathing. You're all right there, kid? You need something? Yeah. And then, you know, and if she's awake, it'll be like something, I want a glass of water. I want to get into bed with you and mama. I want blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But when she's in that other state, sometimes she won't answer, but sometimes she'll say something.
Gibberish.
Nah, it's rarely gibberish. Once she said, I had to ask her twice, and then finally she just said, it's under the bed.
Okay, that's terrifying.
And that's all she would say.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two things mm-hmm. about that. Number one, I was certain there was nothing under her bed.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly nothing like that I should worry about, right? I mean, yeah. I knew that for a fact, mm-hmm. in the way that I know if I toss a ball up, it's going to fall back down.
Yeah, yeah.
But you better bet your ass I had to go look under the bed before I could go back to sleep, yeah. much less, you know, try to put her back in bed from her sleepwalking.
My a family member of mine who's in their 30s still has night terrors, and they've had it since they were children. And if they stay at a place that is not theirs, it is like 100% guarantee they're going to have a night terror. It's like I can't explain it. When they wake up and they don't recognize where they are, it like brings this whole deep fear to them. And they sleepwalk, and I then that's where we get it, like night terrors. Oh man, they feel like someone is sitting on their chest, and that's when we're gonna open up this box of night terrors, and what they actually are. And a lot of people have these apparently. Some people say it's a black dog sitting on their chest. Some people say it's a demon. And what that reminds me of is, as a art history nerd, the Henry Fuseli's The Nightmare, where you have, and if you guys want to look that up on your phones or on your computer right now, I highly encourage you to do it. It is a really creepy painting of a demon sitting on someone's chest and then a literal black horse in the background, the quote unquote nightmare in the background. It's a really good painting. But yeah, this is a cross-cultural, cross-generational, like people would almost say it's like a disease, night terrors, and a specific one where you can't breathe and you're conscious, but
so is that the same thing as sleep paralysis?
Yeah, so sorry. Okay. Yeah, sorry. So yeah, you could say sleep paralysis. And this goes back a long time. According to some of my research, the first like person to write about this wrote about it during the plague. And so that makes me draw.
Well, that wasn't a stressful time at all.
Well, no, I can't well that makes me draw
had sleep problems.
Yeah, and then that makes me draw, you know, compatibility to what's going on right now with the coronavirus and the dreams, and then what was happening in the 1300s.
At least we don't have those plague doctor masks. Have you seen those? God, I mean, Jesus. You want to talk about something giving you a nightmare.
Yeah, and you look at coronavirus and dreams, and like the first image that pops up is one of those masks. But yeah, the word nightmare comes from a visitor or something coming to you at night. And be it like a succubus or an incubus. So the literal term nightmare. Yeah. So you'll take that
mare
as.
Mare isn't like an
entity, a demon, a succubus, incubus. So yeah, people have been having nightmares and been writing about them for, you know, almost 1,000 years. It's not a new thing. Sleep paralysis is not like a new thing that we get because we're all heavily medicated or. Everyone now they're scary movies and people have nightmares about scary movies. It's been a thing for a long time. It's a condition that's happened for a long time.
I thought it was the fluoride in the water.
Yeah, I mean, no, that's supposed to make you complacent.
Or it was that mumps vaccine.
Or was that the mumps vaccine? Yeah. So yeah, when it comes to nightmares, there's a big hole to jump down, and this movie kind of deals with a lot of that. It deals with anxiety, stress, the fear to actually fall asleep. I can't imagine being...
Yeah, the fear of sleep itself. Yeah. The fear of sleep itself and the position that puts you in when you can't.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never been afraid to fall asleep, mm-hmm. but I've been prevented
from
falling asleep for days in a row due to my own nature or my own stress or, you know, my kids not being mm-hmm. able to sleep. Mm-hmm. And, man, after a couple of days,
it really affects you.
Person.
Well, you don't... And then you don't realize if you're dreaming or not. It's... They're, like, people, from what I've been told... If you haven't slept in days, it's hard to like assess what is real and what is not.
Oh, no, I think that, but I actually think that's been confirmed, is that if you go without sleep long enough, what happens is that your mind starts catching little micro naps.
It sleeps for you. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's not, of course, it's not the kind of sleep you really need. It's not that deep restorative sleep, mm-hmm. but it's basically sort of, you know, turning 75% of itself off mm-hmm. to catch those little breaks when it can. Because, of course, if you go without sleep long enough, you will, in fact, die.
Or die in your sleep. It's creepy. Nightmares.
Being human's great.
I'm not. Yeah. I'm not a fan of nightmares. I do love horror and everything about it. There's some things about it I don't, like the dark humor that Freddy uses. But... Nightmares, I'm literally afraid to have a nightmare. You know, that's a crazy fear to have as well.
I'm more afraid of, and this is just because I have such a history of insomnia, mm-hmm. but I'm more afraid of trying to go to sleep and needing to go to sleep and not being able to. Like, I had insomnia so bad for so long that I have a kind of dread about that even now when I get into bed.
I stress about that too. There's this like thought I'll have in my head that, dude, you better go to sleep now or you're going to have the worst day ever. And that thought alone psychs me out so much that I can't go to sleep. The whole like, you need to go to sleep. I just don't, I don't know. I guess I don't take orders well, especially from my own brain.
Oh yeah. Nothing will mess up me falling asleep worse than one of the few things that'll mess up me trying to fall asleep badly is knowing that I have a meeting early the next morning.
Yeah, that's...
It doesn't matter if it's in person or on the phone or whatever, but if I know I have to be up and sort of...
That's it for me too.
And ready to go at a certain time, mm-hmm. I'll just lie there worrying about whether or not I'm going to oversleep.
God.
So much that I barely sleep at all.
It's such a battle. And then you hear those Z-Quil commercials that trigger me where they're like, you have to wake up in 6 hours. You have to wake up in 2 hours.
They know their target market.
You have to wake up in five minutes. That's literally how it goes.
That's market research right there, they're good at it.
It triggers me. Like, I'll be driving, and I'll hear that commercial on the radio because my CD player doesn't work, so yeah, I listen to the radio when I drive. And I just don't. Yeah, I don't like it. It gives me an icky feeling. So if you haven't seen the poster art for A Nightmare on Elm Street and its four subsequent sequels... you're missing out. They are hand-painted by an author named Matthew Joseph Peake. And they're painted in this, like, surrealist style that looks to be, like, heavily influenced by Salvador Dali. There's floating eyeballs and things in the mist and just gnarly colors. And it's really impactful. And you don't actually get to see what Freddy looks like on these posters until the third one, The Dream...
Is it the Dream Warriors?
The Dream Warriors, yeah.
That's my favorite. I mean, it's horrible, but of all the sequels, it's my favorite.
The friend that I mentioned earlier that's obsessed with Freddy Krueger, that's his favorite one as well. But these posters are really, really well done, and they're hand-painted. God, they just don't do that anymore, and you can tell, and it really sucks. But I remember as a kid seeing these at Blockbuster. And they're super eye-catching. And as a child, they're creepy.
They used to be one of my favorite things when video stores were still a thing. Mm-hmm. When I started watching scary movies very mm-hmm. young is, you know, you would going in there and just seeing all those VHS box covers.
Yeah.
And you're right. They were all hand-painted then, mm-hmm. you know, lurid.
Like the Indiana Jones ones that are hand-painted. God, it's just so good. We lost that art somewhere. Like, I don't know. Somebody needs to find someone who hand paints posters again and give them a damn job.
We just need to turn off the internet.
Yeah, that's, well, then we wouldn't be able to have this. Now, would we?
It's a double-edged sword, but I'm prepared to take one for the team, says the guy who makes a living.
Yeah. Well, they more than likely, like, helped. The video sales for this movie were incredible. Also, they spent a couple of $1 million making this film, and they made it back instantly, almost the first weekend it was open. And New Line was kind of in the rut, and the new nickname for New Line is the house that Freddie built, because it jump started their New Line.
Really
again.
Brought yeah. them back.
Brought them back, and video sales also did. And it's probably. They probably should have, I'm sure they did, but they probably should have given Matthew Joseph Peak a little bit of compensation for pushing those video sales, because just strictly his artwork is really, really well done.
Well, it's interesting how surrealist art works, you mm-hmm. know, especially if you're going to compare it to dreams, and that, you know, there aren't necessarily logical associations. In fact, mm-hmm. often the associations seem completely illogical,
mm-hmm.
But that's not to say that there's not an association. Does that make sense? I mean, yeah. they put these elements together that you wouldn't necessarily think belong together. Mm-hmm. But then the second you see them together,
mm-hmm.
You know, the good ones, they sort of dig something out of your subconscious that...
It's like a skill that some artists have and some don't. And it's the like floaty, like spatial... differences of like Salvador Dali's work really interpret into these posters as well. Like, just they seem random, but if you're thinking about a nightmare you've had, it makes sense. It's really interesting. Surrealism is so, I mean, we could sit here and talk about it for a long, long time. But it is so dreamy and so unique. And I love art that affects each individual differently. And these posters seem to do that. I can't talk about it enough. These posters are fantastic. Let's talk about our favorite scenes in the film.
Okay, yeah, we've got a list here of some of our favorite shots.
Mm-hmm.
So we mentioned the 500 gallons of fake blood, mostly used in Johnny Depp's death scene.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of blood.
Yes, and that is at the 108, 1 hour and 8 minutes and 33 seconds. Mark, where you get to see Johnny Depp swallowed by his bed,
mm-hmm.
which is horrifying enough.
Yeah.
Only then there's just this like this fountain of blood, like
Geyser
somebody was making a red smoothie and mm-hmm. left the lid off the blender, and
it
up it goes.
It's shot differently too, where it almost feels like a dreamy thing as well, where you can tell they're shooting it in reverse. So like. Do you guys know what I'm talking about? When you can tell something is being shot in reverse, it's almost like pulling back instead of coming out. That's the effect used in this blood fountain. And man, is it good. And if you want to see Johnny Depp's first, you know, role in a film and what that accumulates to, check this scene out. It's an hour and 8 minutes into the film, and it's very famous. Number one for killing Johnny Depp. Number two for the amount of blood used.
Probably the most famous,
mm-hmm.
though, is next on the list.
Mm-hmm.
And this is at 32 minutes and 10 seconds. And this is a scene where the main character, Nancy,
mm-hmm.
is taking a bath.
Yes.
This
scene. Yeah,
she's trying to stay awake for obvious reasons. She doesn't want to go to sleep where the killer can get to her again. But she's in the bath. You know, the camera is placed at the end of the tub. So we're sort of looking down the tub at her. You can see her. You can see her face, and you can see her knees sort of poking up
mm-hmm.
out of the sudsy water. And then you see Freddy Krueger's claw, that knife hand, mm-hmm. slowly coming up out of the tub.
From between her legs.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing like overly sexual going on in this scene or anything. It's just this subtle shot where it gives you the heebie-jeebies. It's just so demented.
Like, is there any nudity in this film?
Not that I really remember.
I don't think there is straight nudity.
No, because after... So,
I mean,
in the scene we're going to talk about here in a little bit, which is post-sex,
yeah.
they're in their clothes again.
Right.
So,
like, yeah, she's wearing a nightshirt.
Yeah,
she's
I think if there was going to be any nudity, it would have been in that scene. And they, yeah, there's not really. Yeah, I don't think there is any.
But that bathtub what's the actress's name who plays Nancy?
Heather Langenkamp.
Heather Langenkamp.
Or Longenkamp.
Or Longenkamp.
We're
or,
Americans.
We couldn't find anyone saying it online. So we're going to say Heather Langenkamp. But anyway, she plays Nancy, and she is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I mean, that actress, her whole look for that movie is just perfect. I mean, she's beautiful, but mm-hmm. she still looks approachable. She mm-hmm. looks, you'd want to take her home to mom.
Girl Next Door yeah. look. And I mean, that's what they were going for. And he did the exact same thing in Scream. I kind of feel like Neve Campbell had that Girl Next Door, like, attractiveness about her. Doesn't look too much differently than Heather Langenkamp's, like, look in this film.
I mean, Neve Campbell's definitely got her own magic, but I don't know if she ever felt Girl Next Door to me.
Really?
I think she's too attractive to be the girl. I don't know. There's something sort of mysterious mm-hmm. about Neve Campbell that is
yeah.
amazing.
Yeah. Oh,
you know, it's very attractive, but mm-hmm. I think it kind of, I don't know. I don't get that Girl Next Door vibe from her. I get something a little more mysterious.
He's casted his female leads really well. And this is no exception. And she's from Tulsa, which isn't far from here. I'm not going to give our listeners around the world an exact location.
Again, we can't have hundreds of people
yeah,
out here.
Again, yeah. So let's talk about our favorite scenes.
So that one was 3210, the infamous bathtub scene. There's also, and this one isn't talked about a lot, but about 26 minutes, 50 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
There's a shot of Freddy Krueger walking into frame. It's very shadowed, and so you just see him in profile, and he's got this. He drops one shoulder a little bit, you know, so those
claw hand
can hang a little bit lower, and yep. it's just the lighting's it's so well done.
It really it's a very like recognizable profile, and we mentioned it earlier when I was talking about his inspiration from Nosferatu. It's really creepy, and
got those prehensile.
Yeah,
arms
they're in the famous boiler room, which was shot in the basement of a prison, and they actually shut it down for health concerns a year after shooting because it had so much asbestos. So there's a nightmare in itself.
SAG's come a long way.
Yeah, but yeah, he's
OSHA.
He's approaching Nancy, and it just starts with his profile up against an orange like fire lit wall, and it's so man, it's beautiful. It's a really good shot, and it's a really good profile of creepy ass Freddy.
Okay, then next, a little earlier in the movie, first death, about 17 minutes and 10 seconds or so. Levi, your favorite scene
yeah.
in the movie, which is Tina, is that her name in the movie,
yeah.
the blonde?
Yeah, and she
she made the unfortunate mistake of having sex in the movie.
You don't do that in Wes Craven
you
films.
You do not do that
you
in
don't
an 80s
do
horror
it.
Film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this scene is, I remember it as a kid, I'd never seen anything like it when I watched this. Again, I always recall back all these movies we're talking about had huge influences on me, or at least scenes did. She gets like dragged out of the bed and then dragged up the wall after she's been cut across the abdomen. And so there's blood
by
everywhere.
Something you can't see.
Yeah, but you can't see it. Yeah. So
because it's happening in her dream, although in this case, of course,
it's
the damage is
her
real.
Real life. Yeah.
But we're seeing it from the real life perspective.
We're seeing it from
her
boyfriend's perspective. Yeah. And it's oh, man, it's so wild. She's being dragged up the wall and across the ceiling, and blood is just going everywhere, and she is screaming bloody murder. It is.
And it's the first real violence
mm-hmm.
in the movie, and it is so immediately.
Mm-hmm. It gets you.
Yeah, over the top. Mm-hmm. I don't mean that in a negative way, over mm-hmm. the top, but in just an arresting kind
yeah.
of way.
It's the first murder, and she had. What's kind of creepy about it, too, is like she had a dream about Freddy the night before, and she told all of her friends, and so all of her friends were over there staying the night. And of course,
because this was the 80s, and it was
yeah.
completely normal for four 15 to 16 year old
to stay in a house by themselves, yeah.
kids of you know, in of mixed sexes in their in mm-hmm. relationships to just sleep wherever,
yeah, yeah,
on
and that's why
wouldn't you?
And this is what happens when you do that. but that scene, the the like terrifying part of it starts at the 17-minute, 10-second mark into the film. If you'd like to check that out, it's again really iconic. Kind of hard to watch though. It's really intense. And then Jonathan, let's talk about one of your favorite shots in the film.
This is not just my favorite shot in this movie. It's one of my favorite. I feel like it's one of the scenes that affected me more than almost any other in any movie. There's a short list of them because, again, as a kid, all I did was watch scary movies. Thanks, Mom and Dad.
Yeah, what was wrong?
I could talk those babysitters into anything.
Yeah.
But at 13 minutes, 55 seconds, so Nancy's in, she's having the beginning of another nightmare. She's falling asleep. She's in bed. And it's just a shot sort of from the foot of her bed to the head of it. You can see her and covers, you know, tucked up, and the wall behind her. And then slowly Freddy's face starts to push sort of through the wall, bending it like it's suddenly made out of latex.
Yeah.
And oh man, of all the individual scenes in horror movies that ever like stuck in my head as a 9-year-old or 10-year-old or whenever I saw them, that's near the top of the list.
Yeah. And his hands are coming down too, like he's going to just grab her.
And you want to talk about surreal, like that's one of those things that simply cannot happen in real life, right? The wall doesn't suddenly start to bend towards you as though there, you know, it's all squishy and there's someone behind it.
Coming out of it. It's a weird fear because you're like, well, that just shouldn't happen. This looks weird.
It's the most basic stuff of nightmares, right? Where the one of the foundational sort of rules of our reality no longer applies.
Bend, yeah. And that's used in other films. The Frighteners, which is a Peter Jackson horror film with Michael J. Fox. That's on the cover.
People forget that's a horror film.
Yeah, it's a comedy too because it's Peter Jackson. It's like Brain Dead or Dead Alive, and then it's used in a lot, you know, recently in this movie that's taken 5 years to come out, The New Mutants by Marvel, which is a X-Men horror movie apparently. On the cover of that, there are beings coming out of the wall, exactly like Wes Craven used for this shot in Nightmare on Elm Street. So yeah, it's an influential shot. It's very effective. It is creepy. They just stretched latex over a hole in the wall and used a stunt double. That's not even Robert Englund. Again, playing Freddy, it's a stunt double. So I wonder if that was early on in the film, like he had this idea and they shot it before they even had Robert Englund. I don't know. That's something we could, you know, y'all could look up or we could look up. But yeah.
So that's A Nightmare on Elm Street. Before we go, here's a larger question for you. If you can only take one movie from Wes Craven's oeuvre, which one?
Oh, it's Scream for me.
Really? Scream?
That movie, that was the first like R-rated horror film I ever watched. And I remember that first scene just affected me so much. Like my brother and I, and this is how twisted we are. My brother and I would watch that before we went to school in the morning. Like, you know, we'd watch that Drew Barrymore scene, like, or we'd watch the killers being revealed, spoiler alert, at the end scene, because that's so effective. You know, movies don't create psychos. Movies make psychos more creative. Scream was awesome to me. And it still is.
All right.
Yeah.
That's valid.
What's yours?
I think I got to go with The Hills Have Eyes.
I was going to say that one is probably my second. Even the remake.
Because that's got, aside from the quality of the movie itself and how terrifying it is, you know, it has my my all-time screen crush, Dee Wallace.
Oh, yeah. Forgot about that. The remake's very effective, too. I remember seeing that in theaters. And it was around the time they were, like, remaking Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and they were getting these really gritty, like hard to watch movies, and that was one of them. I'd never seen the original before. I actually saw the remake in theaters, and then I went back and watched the original, and yeah, I love it.
I haven't seen the remake because that's one of those movies that's so perfect to me. I don't want to see the remake. Like I don't need a remake.
Yeah, and a lot of people feel that way about the remake of this film. Where Freddy's not Robert Englund anymore, and some people are like, well, that's cause enough for me to not watch this. It's played by Jackie Earle Haley, Most of you will know him from Watchmen. He plays Rorschach in the Watchmen movie that Zack Snyder did. But he, and I thought that was great casting, but that movie just doesn't. With most remakes, you just don't get the feel that you get from the original. Yeah. You don't get that it influenced so much. So it's lackluster. But yeah, another effective performance of Freddy, but not as good as Robert Englund's.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's it for this time. As always, please do take a minute and leave us a review in the Apple directory or your preferred podcast directory.
Like, share.
Really does help help the show in terms of those algorithms that now rule our entire lives from birth to death.
So, all I will say to end this is sweet dreams, everyone.
Indeed.